2,500 of the world's top athletes are in Kona this week for this year's Ironman competition. Our contributing reporter, Sherry Bracken, is on the line with us from the Big Island. Sherry, hard to believe we are marking the 40th anniversary of this race.
It's pretty impressive that people continue to want to do a 140.6-mile race in the Kona heat. And yes, it is amazing.
So I imagine, though, that everybody's encouraged because they're bringing a crowd, and that means business for people.
Well, that is a really, it's a good point every year. You know, Ironman was established in October, which is normally a slow season for tourism anyway. And, of course, we had a real downturn in tourism May, June, July, August, because of the lava, even in September a little bit. So, yeah, this is good because Diana Birch, the race director, tells me that they are definitely expecting around 30,000 people in Kona on race day, and that includes the 2,550 athletes, their supporters, volunteers, media, sponsors, you know, everybody. And it's just, it's an amazing event, and it's great for tourism.
And how's the weather? I know the bog has been an issue for everybody, from farmers to just folks, you know, out there breathing the air.
Well, you know, since August 7th, when the lava stopped, we have had, I will use the term zero fog, but I just recorded an interview with a Hawaiian Volcano Observatory scientist, and the amount of fog being emitted at this point is just hardly anything compared to what it has been. And since that day, Kona has had the most spectacular skies anybody has ever seen. And as Diana Birch, the race director, said, and something that I have observed and I've shared with Bill Dorman, our news director, total strangers on the street stop and talk to each other and point out clouds, and we all enjoy sunrises and sunsets, blue skies, things that we just were missing. You know, we've had fog for a long, long time, but it was so intense during the 3 months that, yeah, the competitors are going to be surprised this year, not by the fog, but by the fact that it's blazing hot with no fog. So,
well,
yeah.
Well, at least they're not breathing in the fog. That's always a problem, too.
No, but you know what's really funny? Several years ago, I did a story for HPR. I just stopped on the side of the road before Ironman. People were training. They were running. I'd stop and ask them, and I asked about six different people, how is this fog affecting you? And the year I did it was probably right after Halemaumau crater refilled with lava, right around 2008 or early, or maybe 2009. And of the six people I stopped, five people who are from the mainland or elsewhere said, what are you talking about? You know, I train in downtown Pittsburgh and this is nothing. Or, you know, one Navy SEAL said, you know, I'm at Camp Pendleton and I'm right next to the freeway. So, yeah, this is nothing. The last person I stopped and talked with who said, oh, my gosh, the air here is just terrible. And I said, well, where are you from? Honolulu. So athletes really have not seemingly minded the fog. It's something that bothers us more than them.
Yeah, well, I'm glad they're going to have good conditions, although I hope it's not too hot.
Well, it probably will be warm now. In the morning, it'll be pleasantly cool, and that will freak out some of the competitors a little bit because usually for most people who are not used to the ocean swim is the most, it's a pretty daunting thing. You're looking at that big ocean, and it'll be a little bit cool in the morning. Then it will get warm after they get on the bike. The weather forecast is for some rain in the afternoon, and we've been having afternoon thunderstorms. So the hope is that it isn't too much rain because that makes it a little challenging for those bikers who are still coming back and for the runners to get their shoes all wet and squishy.
Well,
let's hope.
Well, what else on the business side can you share with us?
On the business side, well, this morning was a great day for business in downtown Kailua Village because the restaurants were packed to watch one of my very favorite events of the week, and that is the Underpants Run. And
Okay. It's
exactly what it sounds like. There were more than 1,000 people running in their underpants. That's a requirement of the race, which was started more than 20 years ago by a group of pro athletes, Rock Fry, Paul Huddle, Paula Newby Fraser, to sort of ridicule some of the athletes who in earlier days used to walk around town in their Speedos and walk into restaurants in their Speedos. So these guys just thought, well, we'll just make it official. And now it's a thing. It's a race. It's a low entry fee, $20, and all the money goes to Big Island charities. So that was good for business today. But other business things, there are folks who will not have business on Ironman Day most especially, because a lot of the roads around Kailua and on the west side of the island are closed. It creates some amount of inconvenience, but overall, the last economic study that was done, which was way back in 2006, indicated there was more than $26 million spent here on the island in connection with Ironman, and that was when they only had 1,700 athletes. Today they have more than 2,500, so the amount has got to be bigger. And you can see it. Restaurants are packed. Grocery stores are a bit depleted of food. Gas stations are busier. Just, you know, there's a lot of people in town, and that's all good.
And I know there was some talk, because there was a ownership change, too, recently.
There was. In 2015, it's Dali and Wanda, which is a Chinese company, purchased World Triathlon Corporation. World Triathlon Corporation is a Florida company that many years earlier bought Ironman. And the concern was, oh, when Dali and Wanda buys Ironman, what's going to happen? And according to both Diana Birch, who's the race director, and Dan Berglund, who is the PR director, Dali and Wanda keeps hands off of certainly the Ironman Triathlon World Championship, which is here, and most of the other Ironman races, their objective being to expand, and they have added a number of races in China, and this year there's more than 30 Chinese athletes who've qualified for Ironman. So Dali and Wanda just wants to grow the sport, particularly in Asia.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was just about to ask whether they expect those numbers from China to go up.
I'm sure they do, because they're adding more every year. So, yeah, I'm absolutely positive that's part of the objective. You know, it's funny, because when you look at 2,500 athletes, I think most people figured that they couldn't physically fit more people onto Kailua Pier, but they seem to manage to keep expanding, and so it's a good thing. It's got inconveniences associated with it, but it's a joyful atmosphere, and although some of the athletes are quite impressed with themselves, most of the athletes are just great people. I ran into two from Brazil last Saturday who were lost in the Kona Old Industrial area, which happens to be where the radio station is, where I do my recording. And they couldn't speak English, and I don't speak Portuguese. But he had an app on his phone, and I asked them where they were going, because it was clear they weren't any place they should have been. And he explained they were looking for a particular vitamin store. I found it. I took them there. And they were just so sweet. And most of the athletes are that way. This is such a dream for them. You know, people practice and work hard for years. In fact, Ironman puts out a statistic that said people who are actually training for Ironman tend to swim about 7 miles a week. They bike 232 miles a week, and they run 48 miles a week. So people put in the time and effort in order to even qualify for Ironman, because you can't just come here. You have to have placed in a previous Ironman race of some kind all over the world, and then they come here. So most of them are just happy as can be to be here.
Well, I'm impressed with them. They're all gods and goddesses in my book. Thanks so much, Sherry.
Let me just mention one more thing. It's a 17-hour race. The fastest people come in around 3 or 3:30, but a lot of people don't even come in till midnight. So you're right. They are gods and goddesses.
All right. Thanks so much.
Aloha.
That was Sherry Bracken tracking the impact of the world-class racing event Ironman 2018. I'm Catherine Cruz, and you're tuned to HPR1. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today in our backyard, we talk location, location, location. Live in an area long enough, and you'll likely see properties fall in and out of the desirable category. But it's not only what's fashionable that creates Tony neighborhoods. Sometimes necessity steps in, and development, unforeseen decades before, makes the decision. Consider Central Union Church. For generations, it's been a landmark on the expansive 8.4-acre property at the corner of Baratania and Punahou Streets. Actually, it's been there since 1924. If you know some of the architectural history of Honolulu, you probably also remember that many buildings in downtown date from the decades following the Great Chinatown Fire in 1886. Now, urban planning began to shape some of the modern Honolulu we see today, so this morning's question is for you history hounds. What do Central Union Church, the Schumann Carriage Car Dealership, and the Hawaii State Capitol all have in common? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Claire Hannis, an immigration attorney, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Future Focus is the title of a conference being held this week. HPR's Wayne Yoshioka was there and is here to tell us all about it.
Well, you know, one thing I learned, Catherine, was that cybersecurity is the future. There were about 300,000 jobs, I guess, nationwide, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and hundreds could not be filled. Salaries in cybersecurity range from about $116,000 annually at the entry level, $150,000 for fully trained technicians, and $500,000 or more for the best in the field. So Hawaii's universities, private and public, they get it, and many students get it. And now the state's 48 public high schools have been redesigned to provide students with pathways to college, work, and careers. High schools have academies in advanced placement for college-bound students, the arts, medicine, engineering, technology, as well as the trades in plumbing and carpentry and culinary and hospitality industries. And all students choose an academy in the eighth grade. A high school vice principal is in charge, along with counselors and community-based business advisory boards. Paul Yokota, president of the FCH Enterprises, parent company of Zippy's, is an advisory board member for Kaimuki High School. He says the academy program there provides real-life experiences.
Every year, we have about a dozen schools that send students to us, and they work for us for a couple months as interns, paid interns, by the way, and they work between 18 to 24 hours a week, depending on what their school schedules are. They learn how to handle their first paycheck, how to start a savings account, how to show up on time and in uniform, how to work with managers and peers.
And so how do we make sure that what we've got in place now is going to produce our workers?
Well, Hawaii educators are focusing on, you know, developing this analytical thinking and problem solving for cybersecurity, and they're giving the students a chance to pick maybe their future occupation. They give them a little leeway in terms of changing it maybe once. But what they're trying to do is make them work ready. They are asking employers if the, you know, if their graduates have the skills and the suitable to excel in the workplace and to take on jobs that really have not been created yet. So Hawaii Pacific University President John Gotanda says employer surveys potentially point the way forward.
The Chronicle of Higher Education came out with a survey of employers and what's the one skill that their new sort of employees really missing, and that's resilience. You know, we have to teach them today to be able to fail and then to pick themselves up and figure out how then to move forward. That's an important skill, and I think collectively that's something that we all need to focus on.
Okay. So the entire education system the entire ecosystem is changing. It focuses on what they call the three R's, relevance, relationships, and rigor, to prepare students for the workplace and careers. And I think many students will gravitate to jobs like we all did, with high income potential or perceived lifestyles. But these are basically not enough. A graduate must be a good fit for the company and eventually take on leadership and executive management roles. You know, the saying goes, lead, follow, or get out of the way.
And there was a time when the school boards from both the DOE and the University of Hawaii met to try and figure out how do we make sure that our young people can continue on the right path to a successful career.
And I think closing the loop, now that the educators are meeting with the community and business members, they can find out, well, what do the businesses need? Like the National Security Agency has 300 jobs in cybersecurity, high-paying jobs, high-skilled jobs, and not only from, well, if the telescope ever gets built. I mean, we have other high-tech jobs there. So, you know, it's really getting to the businesses and the operators out there in the community to ask them, what do you need? You know, I'm sure it's more than hula dancers at the hotels.
And whether it's a Zippy's?
Whether it's a Zippy's or what any business, you have to have employees that can get along, that can take orders from management, and can eventually become a leader, being able to lead their fellow, their peers in your business in order to advance forward.
And at this conference, did they talk at all about money and maybe increasing funding either for the schools or the university, you know, as far as in these areas where they want to channel students?
No, because University President David Lasner says the students really vote on what they want to do because they go for courses in cybersecurity and leave the other courses behind. So they have to channel their resources to cybersecurity courses or courses like in health or, you know, medicine and all those others that the students are saying, we want this or we're going to go elsewhere.
And do we have enough educators in these areas who can train our young people for these fields?
I think the National Security Agency has stepped up. A lot of federal agencies have stepped up to this, stepped up to the plate and said, you know, if we need this, we're going to help you get that these kinds of people to work for us. So it's really a collaborative effort on the part of NSA and the universities.
What other types of organizations were in attendance this week?
The FBI came by, talked about cybersecurity and, you know, the threats that they pose. Some other people like bank institutions, a lot of people from government that says, you know, if our computer systems are breached, I mean, we are really going to be in a hard place. So I think there was a lot of give and take and a lot of learning for everyone.
And did you attend any sessions where they talked about our vulnerabilities and the attacks that we've had on our system?
Well, they did discuss that, but because of privacy issues and because of they don't want to reveal what their tactics are, they talked about it in a very generalistic way. But, you know, it's really a threat that we all have to deal with. I mean, everyone has private information that can be breached, and, you know, you put yourself out there vulnerable.
Future focus. Okay, it's a whole new world.
It's a whole new world.
Wayne Yoshioka, political reporter for HPR. Thank you. That time for our reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Reporter Stuart Yurton has been tracking what's hot these days in the world of Instagram. He's on the line with us this morning. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Catherine.
So tell us about this. I know some of our staff, we were reading the article this morning, are, wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah. So today I have a profile of a company called Plotiverse, and it's actually based on Maui, and it has created an app for essentially animating photographs, and it's very popular on Instagram.
And it seems like it's really bling, right, for Instagram posts.
Yeah, it is. It's actually really cool. You could call it bling. It's just it sort of animates and enhances these photographs. But it seems to be very popular. You know, we first heard about it at the Online News Association conference in Austin, Texas, where one of the trainers for Instagram singled it out as one of her favorite apps, and that led us to look into it. And it turned out the company was based here, so we said, well, let's talk to them and see what they're all about.
So now they weren't from here originally; they moved over here, right?
Right. They founded in New York. The founder is a photographer named Troy Plota, and he was a longtime commercial photographer. His partner and the sort of partner and business partner, Sasha Scheider, was an artist, and they started this company Troy went all in on it. He sold all of his photo gear and really, really went for it with this new technology.
I love the name Plotiverse. I mean, he's got his name out there.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, and it is cool. I mean, the images really are beautiful. Some of them, the things you see if you go to their website, they have contests every day where they get people to sort of post their own things and animate photos that the company posts. And again, we're talking about very high-end photographers. Like one of their fans that I interviewed is someone named Michael Muller. He does all the big posters for Marvel Studios. So all of these, you know, the Deadpool and these really classic images that you see when you go to the movies, plus celebrity photos. He's a big fan. You know, he thinks it's here to stay. And it's very easy to use as well. And that's, I think, part of the appeal of this. They have 6 million downloads so far.
And they've got a lot of celebrities that are fans.
Yes, they do. So if you go to the story, you'll see some cool pictures. One from Paris Hilton uses it a lot.
Yes.
These influencers like her. There's a really cool, there's a link to something. Ariana Grande used it to animate one of her photographs. You'll see that. It's the celebrities, these influencers seem to like it. The Kardashians, Kim and Kourtney have used it. So it's very popular.
It's kind of curious, though, that they decided to just relocate here to Maui.
Yes, it is. They just liked it, and I guess they had the opportunity to move here, and they're really glad to be sort of away from everybody. Troy said that they were getting interest from investors. They went ahead and raised money from friends and family. Now, and they just didn't want people trying to tell them what to do. And they have this vision. They're really executing this vision, and that's where they are right now. So, yeah, they like being on Maui, out of the fray, where they can really create this, what's now turning into both a tool for animating the photographs and a community. They want to kind of create this social network, which is the Plotiverse thing. The actual app, one of them is called Plotograph, which is like the picture animating app.
Well, Plotiverse, Plotograph, Maui, no ka'oi, right? Thanks so much, Stuart.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was reporter Stuart Yurton with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
this week on Says You.
This is the first time in over 4 years that all six of our original panelists have sat together. Nice to have you back in the original lineup, folks.
May I make a suggestion?
I'd like that.
I think we could call this original syntax.
A game as fast as it's fun, and everyone's a winner. Says You.
This evening at 6:30.
Journalist Gary Kubota has covered news in the islands for 40 decades. Now he's come out with a book called Stories of Change, thanks to Kukua Hawaii Oral History Project and a grant from the Hawaii Council of Humanities and the Hawaii People's Fund. Now Kubota credits the idea for the book to Lawrence Kamakaveva-Olde. He was a leader of the group fighting to save pig farmers from being evicted from Kalama Valley out in East Honolulu. Now as a teen, Kubota was actually arrested when he took part in one of those protests. He reflected on how that experience and how Kamakaveva-Olde's idea came together.
He was one of the leaders opposing the eviction of Kalama Valley residents, and the organization was Kukua Kalama initially, but then it was called Kukua Hawaii. And so he'd seen my play called Legend of Ko'olau at the Hawaii Theater, and he loved the play. It was about a Native Hawaiian hero, Kalawai Ko'olau, who resisted leprosy, forced the movement of lepers to Kalapapa, and basically fought off the militias that had overthrown the monarchy. And he liked to play, and so he and Pete Thompson, who was on his deathbed, I guess, at the time, they were talking about who should do a book. Or something like that, and they decided that they'd approach me.
Oh, interesting.
And that's how it happened.
Okay, yeah. But now you also had a sidebar story going because you took part in...
Yeah,
I wasn't
initially at Kukua. I just went to support them and to get arrested. I was, like many people from that era, I was like a peace activist and opposed to the Vietnam War, and protesting against the eviction of farmers and Native Hawaiians just seemed a really good thing to do, because why not? I mean, we were already protesting the bombing of Asians who I'd never met, you know, and so it was just a kind of a natural step in terms of activism to take that position. You know, and then there were so many contradictions at the time. The Vietnam War was going on. You'd see, like, the names of Hawaiians and Filipinos and sometimes Japanese who died in Vietnam as soldiers. And then you go to the University of Hawaii, and I tell you, you know, you could look at 300 students walking around. Maybe you were lucky if you saw three or four Filipinos or Hawaiians. So there was kind of like this whole practice of channeling certain minorities to become soldiers. And, you know, it was an act essentially of what I refer to as institutionalized racism. This country has had, you know, the privileged classes don't have to go to war and others do. You know, I was a bit upset about that whole kind of setup, in addition to the fact that there wasn't much mention about the contributions of minorities from Hawaii in American history books. So, you know, I supported the beginnings and the establishment of the ethnic studies program at the University of Hawaii.
So then after your little stint as an activist and you know, who got arrested as part of this, then you became a journalist.
Then I became a journalist because I realized that it was an important role that I could play in terms of not so much slanting stories, but just deciding that, you know, I would actively pursue some stories that others may not have an interest in, because they don't have the background. Like when farmers in Kia and I would complain that their taro fields were drying up because the water had been diverted by sugarcane companies, I would check into it and I'd write a story. And then I'd call the sugarcane companies. Of course, they deny it. But then, miraculously, two or three days later, the water would start running into the taro fields again. And so they call me on a regular basis. And then Walter Reddy, like that, complained about illegal sand mining and how nobody was doing anything about it. And I paid attention. I found out, I kind of like waited for the trucks to drive by, and then I followed them on the next day and recorded where they went to Moamomi and recorded where they went to Pacific Concrete. Then I checked with the county, and 6 months later, the county said, yeah, no, they don't have permits. And so they stopped the Pacific Concrete from taking sand from the area. Then I wrote my story.
Right. I mean, but you really, well, you're a watchdog is what you are. And so tell us about how then this whole book got going.
Basically, I saw friends of mine who were activists sick or dying. And, you know, I wanted to interview them just to get it on tape. And so, you know, I selected, it was like triage interviewing in the beginning. Like I interviewed Kalani Ohello, who already had lost a leg due to diabetes. I interviewed Moani Keala Kaka, who was a former OHA trustee, arrested also in Calama Valley, with me and Kalani. And she, 3 months later, she contracted cancer. And both of them have died since the interview. And so it was an attempt to try and get a hold of these kinds of activists first. But and then it began to expand. Rather than just Kukua Hawaii members, I interviewed presidents of various community associations, or else their children and wives who remembered Kukua Hawaii working in the communities. Because I worked in Oda Camp as a volunteer. I was invited, along with two other Kukua Hawaii members, to live in Oda Camp. And we stayed there for several months when there were no offers and when public opinion was still against, against or neutral as far as, like, them being evicted. And in those ensuing months, we were able to kind of help to turn the tide a bit in terms of public opinion. We created posters. We helped them have media days. We did research for them. You know, all of this is, when it came to the community side, we played a background role a lot of times because we're trying to develop community leaders and to support them in their decisions. We weren't trying to choreograph anything, but we wanted to make sure that the principles of what we called self-determination were realized as much as possible. So in the case of Oda Camp, Pete Tagalog was the one that spoke at the hearings and meetings, and we talked with Pete during steering committee meetings, on ideas and things like that. And what happened was, as a result of that, after Calama Valley on May 11, 1971, you had these several other communities facing evictions: Waiholi, Waikani, Alava Housing, Census Tract 57 in Hikina and Akepo Lanes in Kalihi, Heiakea, Chinatown, something on Kauai, I think it was Nukolii, and they all called Kukua Hawaii and asked for help. And so we developed into a cadre organization and a community organizer organization. And we coordinated certain events, such as rallies, and also, like, in terms of ethnic studies, gathering presidents of various community associations and associations that supported us to occupy the building, at the administration building at the University of Hawaii Manoa.
That's right. I remember
to
continue
that. Continue ethnic studies. Yeah.
It's just so interesting because you were able to record these interviews with so many people. I know when I saw the cover of your book, I was like, oh, I know her. I know him. You know, and it just, with all our time, you know, covering all these news stories over the decades. And it's funny because I think the last time I went back to Hawaii Kai, I was on my bike and I think I almost got chased out by a feral pig and her piglets. But I was just kind of musing over, you know, how that valley has changed.
Yeah, it's changed considerably. I mean, obviously, it's like, you know, it's for upper middle class people, if not, more upper class. The thing about it was basically that it was the beginning of opposing land evictions that affected a whole slew of people, but mainly affected at that time Native Hawaiians and farmers. And these are the ones that are getting pushed from one valley to the next. George Santos had been pushed out of various valleys multiple times. He was the pig farmer and also one of the spokesmen for Kukua Hawaii. We're a multi-ethnic organization. In Waiholi Waikani, of course, there was one guy who had actually, a farmer, who had actually been evicted from Kalama Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'm not leaving anymore. I'm going to put my money. So he gave Waiholi Waikani a large contribution to fight the eviction.
Yeah, whether it's pig farmers or taro farmers.
Can you imagine having Hawaiian culture without taro? Or being an environmentalist and allowing the development of hotels at Sandy Beach? These are things that, you know, right now would be unthinkable. But back then, those are the kinds of things that were proposed.
Right, and the residents there took a stand.
And there are individuals who weren't residents, not only in Kukua, Hawaii, Bob Nakata. He was a volunteer community organizer. He was working for Key Campaign, later became a state senator, and he's continued to be a voice for housing for the poor and for working people. You know, recently they recognized Bob for his work at the state legislature in developing a bill, $200 million bill, to assist in development of that kind of housing. And George Cooper, who was an associate of ours, he became, of course, the author, co-author of Land Empowering Hawaii.
That's right, with Gavin Dawes.
George actually stayed at my place for about a week while he was researching for the book, you know, when I lived on Maui. I still live on Maui.
Well, this must be very gratifying for you then.
I'm really happy the way it turned out, but you know, when you begin, you're always beginning with this kind of a sense of, well, you know, I'm going to just try my best. Initially, you know, when I started, there was no money or grants involved. I just wanted to do it because I thought it was the right thing. And I started about 3 years ago, you know, doing the interviews. And the initial grant actually called for me, probably they were expecting 15 to 20 interviews.
Mm.
And it ended up being more than 30 interviews. And I was just thinking of a spiral binding folder because I couldn't afford to do much else, you know. I mean,
right.
And then suddenly UH Press and Gavin saw a copy of the book and he liked what he saw. So he, you know, called UH Press and asked them to help me at least in terms of the printing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, UH Press is not the publisher, but they did help in connecting us with their printer, and we got a significant discount on the printing of the book, which enabled us to, of course, have this book signing and everything.
Kubota, who's retired from the newspaper business, says, reflecting on his career, he's proud that some of his recent stories have led to community building and change in state law. One relates to the move to keep units on Front Street affordable, and a second bill closed a loophole in our system that now requires families of someone suffering from mental illness who's in the judiciary system to be notified of proceedings. Two book signings will take place on Oahu this weekend at Windward Community College midday Saturday and at Nemea Bookstore at Ward Center on Sunday afternoon. Kubota says the book will go into a second printing, and he expects other signings will take place on the neighbor islands as well. For links, go to our webpage at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, I'm Liam Skilling from the William S. Richardson School of Law. You can hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HPR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
This morning, we asked you to tell us what Central Union Church, the Schumann Carriage Car Dealership, and the Hawaii State Capitol have in common. Each comes from distinct time periods in Honolulu's development, yet there's an element they all share. After the Great Chinatown Fire in 1886, two congregations merged to create Central Union Church. In 1892, it then moved to a new building at the corner of Baratania Street and Richards. Progress being what it is, the next 30 years brought urbanization and noise, especially the clatter and bell clinging of the electric streetcars. The church then moved to its present location in 1924. Soon after, the Schumann Carriage Company bought the old church building, and for about four decades, it was a car dealership. By the 1960s, construction on the Hawaii State Capitol was about to begin. The state needed two full city blocks, so everything located on the properties had to go. Today, the corner of Baratania and Richard Street is part of the open grounds of the Capitol, but once had been home for Central Union Church and Schumann Carriage. Thanks to the Bishop Museum Archives for today's quiz, and a shout-out to Kamana Seymour, who got the answer right. You had fast fingers. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Nanette Napoleon. Sounds French enough. Well, Hawaii cemetery historian shares with us that she has family ties to French President Napoleon Bonaparte, but through his brother Lucien and his time in Tahiti. But it was a visit to Père Lachaise in Paris that Napoleon discovered her passion for places for the dead. She had just graduated from the University of Hawaii in the 70s and was on a backpacking trip through Europe when someone suggested she go find musician Jim Morrison's grave. We spent time with Napoleon at the Oahu Cemetery on Memorial Day, poring over the Book of Record, looking for the French connections in our graveyard. She shared her memory of Père Lachaise.
We found the cemetery and then walked through the gate. Now, Morrison's grave is kind of far, a little bit far from the gate, so you have to walk quite a bit of ways. So in that walk, we had general directions and a map, I think. I started looking at the monuments there, and I was just blown away. I'd never seen anything like this in my entire life. There were statues and big, huge monuments and busts and all kinds of things to look at, incredible pieces of artwork. And I had been studying art history in college, not as a major, but I've always been interested in that. And I was also studying European literature. So I knew some of the poets of Europe and France in particular. And as we were walking, I started recognizing names from people I studied in college. And I'm going, what? And then so I was just blown away, that aspect of the beautiful monuments and the history of the people. And then we get to Jim Morrison's grave, and it was incredible. There were lots of people there that day. As there were, I learned that, you know, it was a big pilgrimage people make there. So we paid our respects and everything.
But did you ever think that you would then get into cemetery history like you had?
No, but that was planted a seed in my mind. And as I traveled throughout Europe, I started looking for the local cemeteries. If there were some in some town or city we were in, and then we would go visit the cemetery. And that's what really got me going. There's really a lot of genealogical resources online now, and more so than I saw 30 years ago when I first started doing my cemetery research, because people didn't have the wherewithal to do research on their ancestors and things, but now they do very easily. And so I've seen a big increase in interest of doing genealogy and in particular finding grave sites, because all of a sudden people are posting pictures of their tombstones online findagrave.com and billiongraves.com, and the people who post it, the postings are only as good as information that's inputted from individuals. So a lot of time you look for the ones that have birth date, death dates, and siblings and spouses listed, and then a photo of the marker. So as that platform, those platforms grow, more people are posting genealogical information there, and
It's easier to find than ever before.
Oh, ever before, and it's opened my world of finding graves of people hundredfold. I use those sites a lot in my work.
And so we've just gone through the Book of Record, and we found several Frenchmen.
Yes, we to our surprise, and it was very exciting to find those Frenchmen here. And as you recall, when we're looking at the record book, is that we saw people from all over the world. Scotland, England,
Ascension Islands, or some of the other ones we found from all over. Guam. We found a number of Guams.
India.
Yeah, India. Native American Indian. We found one Native American Indian. We found just from everywhere along the globe. And that shows you how much Hawaii was really it wasn't this isolated place that most people thought it was, even in the 1800s. There were lots of people from all around the world coming to Hawaii and knew of Hawaii, mostly whalers and merchant ships that were traded in the Pacific Rim and area.
But it's a snapshot of our history.
It's a snapshot of our history and the fact that a lot of these individuals ended up either dying on the ship and their shipmates erected a cenotaph in their honor, a marker for them, that they had to pull their money and buy a marker for them, but they're not actually buried here, they're buried at sea. Or they came into Port Ill and they were sent to the local British Seamen's Hospital or the American Seamen's Hospital to recover, but they didn't. And then the seamen, their shipmates, had to buy them a marker, buy them a plaid and buy them a marker. Mm-hmm. So they remain here. They never made it back home.
But still, it's just an interesting history in a kind of an open-air museum.
Yeah, I call cemeteries outdoor museums.
And so we continued our conversation in the outdoor museum. We walked past the shower trees and the weather-worn headstones. We were, after all, on a hunt for the Frenchman. The tombstone of a French artist is just inside the entrance of the Nu'uanu Cemetery. It's tucked away in a corner, just in the shadow of one of those King Kamehameha markers. The stonework was paid for by, are you ready for this? The Bohemian Club.
Deuce Tavernier was a Frenchman who grew up in Paris and attended the École des Beaux-Arts, the School of Fine Arts in Paris, France, and graduated there and started a private practice of teaching painting to wealthy women and mostly socialites. But he also had his own, was making work and trying to sell his work, but he needed to supplement his income by teaching. But he got tired of doing that, so he went west as a young man, and he actually got a commission from Harper's Magazine to write about his travels out west. And then he ended up in San Francisco, and he became a member of the Bohemian Club, which was a group of rich men, a private club, and they supported the arts and many. This monument, this rock, actually comes from Monterey or someplace in California.
Wow, so they erected it in his honor.
Yeah, in his honor here.
And how did he end up here, do you know?
So the story is that he had drinking problems from the time in Paris, okay? And in San Francisco, he had the same thing, and he had some debts, and he was ran away, kind of. And then he ended up in Honolulu, and he started classes for wealthy patrons as well. But then he also became, this is where he became the most famous as an artist, because he would travel up to the brim of the exploding volcano and paint scenes of the erupting volcano, Kilauea, and other landscape scenes from all over the Big Island, mostly.
And so where is his art? Is it at Honolulu Academy?
Yes, there's Academy has a number of his original artworks. And one of them is, the one that's most famous is the one that resides at the volcano house on the Big Island. It used to be over the fireplace. I'm not sure where it is now. I think they moved it. But it's a very, very famous erupting volcano.
We came across a headstone of another Jules, French sea captain Jules Dudouis. His estate was not far from where he's buried. He also had a ranching operation on Molokai, but it was his grisly death at the hands of his Chinese cook that sent chills up my spine.
That said Aussie, with force and arms, in and upon one Jules Dudouis, being the elder person of that name, willfully, feloriously, with malice afterthought, and without authority, justification, or extermination by law, did make an assault in and upon the neck and face of said Jules Dudouis with a certain instrument called a cleaver, which the said Aussie, otherwise called Ahusie, in his right hand, then and there, had and held, did inflict one mortal wound
to wit, of the length of 7 inches and the depth of 2 inches, of which said mortal wound, the said Jules du Doigt, did for a considerable space of time, to wit, for the space of 1/2 hour, then and there lived, and thereafter, by reason of wound aforesaid, was aforesaid, unlawfully and with malice afterthought, and without any authority, justification, or execution by law, inflicted by said Assi, otherwise called Ahusi, did there die.
What a story.
That's directly from the court records. So the story is that he and his wife, Anne, were sleeping in their bedroom on the second story of their large house in Nuuanu when their cook, for unknown reasons, burst into their chambers and stabbed the captain. So Du Doigt was sleeping in his bed alongside his wife about 2 a.m. when attacked and killed by Assi. Mrs. Du Doigt awoke after hearing her husband's body fall off the bed. The first thing she saw was Assi standing over her with a bloody cleaver in his hand, ready to strike her, which he did several times, after which he fled from the room. Mrs. Du Doigt survived her wounds. Assi was tried and convicted. He was hung by the neck until dead on December 15, 1866.
Awe, or would that be mon dieu? I couldn't resist including that story. It is, after all, almost Halloween. And there you have some obscure French history in a Hawaii graveyard now unearthed. And that was our conversation with Nanette Napoleon, cemetery historian. We were talking about the French connections with Hawaii. Napoleon only visited the historic Père Lachaise Cemetery once, and that was in 1972. A return trip, she says, is on her bucket list. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, Price of Paradise Revisited. What's your story as you watch the median price of a home head toward the $1 million mark? How are you coping with the price of paradise? Is owning your own home a pipe dream? Think lawmakers are doing enough to cut red tape to spur the growth of inventory? Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.